Well, everywhere you look, I think people are searching for some secret to make their relationships work. The other day I bought a couple of popular magazines, New Idea and Women's Day, to see what they had to say about relationships, and it's very informative. I don't know if you buy those on a regular basis or every now and again. Very informative to see what they have to say about relationships. One of the features in New Idea was called The Outer Limits, and it was subtitled Your Destiny from Reading the Tarot Cards. Listen to a typical letter that was sent into that column. The lady writes, "I'm a widow of a couple of years, and I have a lover as I did not have a good marriage. He tells me that I'm his girl. He promises to ring as he lives in another town, but he never does. When he is in town, he stays with me for a couple of days, then he leaves. And her question is, will he come and live with me?" Now, the reply that she received went like this. "The cards point to this never happening. I see him remaining your lover, but not becoming your full-time partner. I feel that this arrangement works for both of you and keeps you together for many years to come." Well, there you go. There you have it. Wisdom according to New Idea, or maybe we should call it No Idea. It would perhaps be a better title for that particular magazine. Well, not to be outdone, Woman's Day can also give you a few tips on building a successful relationship. For example, you can send a sample of your handwriting in and have it analysed by their handwriting expert, Hera Sanderson. One woman sent in a sample of her writing, and it was very loopy. They had an example of it there. It had big loops all over it. And Hera wrote to her, and she said this. She said, "Rather like arms reaching out wide to grasp the elusive, your wide loops reveal your sexual drive and other unfulfilled fantasies." How about that for just a bit of handwriting? She said, "They reflect your difficulty in being realistic about experiences. These loops show that you tend to become impulsively entangled in a variety of activities." Great stuff, isn't it? "Reducing the width of these loops," and this is where it really gets good, "reducing the width of these loops would help out more balance." "It would also enable you to be less sensitive to criticism. In turn, this could bring greater fulfilment in achievement and intimacy." So there you go. In order to get your life straight, you've just got to change your handwriting. That's where the action's at. After reading that, I became rather inspired, and so I went to Susan, my wife, and I said to her, "Now, what would you say about me on the basis of my handwriting?" And she said, "The fact that it's impossible to read means that you're very insecure and you're trying to hide from people." Well, that wasn't all the secrets that Women's Day had to offer. You could write in and get advice from Dear Fiona. You could find out if you and your partner were compatible by reading Athena's Astro Love Number Guide. Or you could write to Selena Summers and figure out how you should arrange the furniture in the house according to the ancient Chinese art of Feng Shui. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it or not, but you know, if you've got sort of lots of tension in the house, then apparently you can sort that out by changing the colours or rearranging where the chairs are within the room. Now, I have to say, quite honestly, I don't think I've ever seen so much rubbish in the pages of a couple of magazines as I've seen in the pages of New Idea and Woman's Day. They are full of absolute trash. But that trash is very telling. I mean, they say that you can tell a lot about people from the trash that they put out, and I guess you can tell a lot about people from the trash that they read. And what you discover from letters such as that, I think, other than that people are extremely gullible, is three things. Firstly, people crave relationships. Secondly, they want them to work. And thirdly, they will do almost anything to make them work. But where do people look to make their relationships work? Well, sure, some people look to tarot cards or Feng Shui or Athena's Number Guide, but I'm not sure that there are many people who really take all of that stuff very seriously. Nowadays, I think people are looking increasingly to psychology to solve their relationship woes. If things aren't right with our relationships, then all we need to do is go to a good analyst or a psychologist, buy a self-help book from down the local bookshop, and everything will be all right, or that's what we're told anyway. Now, as is always the case, this attitude to psychology has, I think, spilled over into the church as well. And if you go to any Christian bookshop, then you'll find the shelves packed with self-help books. A lot of them claim to be biblically based, and some of them are biblically based. But more often than not, they're simply potted psychology. And interestingly, though, these are the books that are selling in our Christian bookshops. A manager of a large Christian bookshop in the United States was once asked, "What's hot these days?" And he answered by saying, "Anything with pain in the title. We can't keep the shelves stocked because they sell so fast." Now, the result of that has been twofold, I think. Firstly, the language of psychology has become a part of the daily life of evangelical Christians. Things like self-esteem and dysfunctional families, codependency, support, unconditional love. These are the words and ideas that we all use. And so our churches in general are full of Sigmund Freud's or Carl Rogers and little versions of them. But secondly, though, I think as a result of our interest in psychology, our confidence in the Bible has to some extent been undermined in the area of relationships. John MacArthur, the American preacher and author, once agreed to debate a man who led a homosexual denomination. And he was debating him about the whole area of homosexuality. And he asked this man, he said, "What do you do with the Bible's condemnation of homosexuality as a sin?" And the fellow that he was debating said, "Oh, come on, everybody knows the Bible is psychologically unsophisticated, reflecting the views of primitive thinking. The Bible is antiquated in its sociological theory. You can't go to an ancient document like this and expect to deal with 20th century problems. The Bible ought to stay in its own environment. It needs to be updated with a contemporary understanding of psychological and sociological theory." Now, sadly, that man is not alone. Many Christians nowadays have little confidence that the Bible on its own is enough to deal with the problems that we face today. They believe that it needs to be supplemented with scientific and sociological insights that we've gained in the 20th century. And the question that I want to ask today is, does psychology hold the secrets to excellent relationships for us? And I don't think that it does. I don't think it does. No doubt many of the things that psychology says are helpful. I don't want to be heard today to be saying that you ought to steer clear of it and have nothing to do with it. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying to you very strongly that it is not the secret to excellent relationships. Because the key, the secret, at least one of them, the key to excellent relationships is holiness. But sadly, you won't find any book down at the local bookshop that tells you that. In fact, even more sadly, you'll be hard-pressed to find many books in the local Christian bookshop that tell you that. James Packer says, in his book Pursuing Holiness, he says, "What do we Christians mainly preach and teach and produce TV programs and video cassettes about these days? The answer seems not to be holiness, but success and positive feelings, getting healthy, wealth, freedom from care, good sex, and happy families." He said, "I remember seeing once a group of 8 new how-to books reviewed on a single page. How long, I wonder, is it since you heard about 8 new books on holiness?" Now, the tragedy is that he's right. We have sold out. We have embraced psychology, expecting it to give us all of the answers. And in doing so, we have turned our back on the thing that is most helpful to us in pursuing excellence in relationships. See, nobody much talks about holiness anymore. But one person who did talk about it a great deal was the Apostle Paul. And I want to look this morning at what he has to say from Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 17 to chapter 5 verse 7. And if you've got your Bible open there, Ephesians 4 verse 20 is where we're going to begin. And Paul says there in Ephesians 4 verse 20, "You, however, did not come to know Christ that way. Now, when he says that way, what way is he referring to? Well, he's encouraging the Ephesians here to give up their old ways of relating, which he's just spoken about in verses 17 to 19. And he says there, "So I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. They are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. Having lost all sensitivity, they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with a continual lust for more." Now, how did they relate? What is Paul saying was the basis of their relationships before they came to know Christ? Well, he says they related on the basis of greed and lust and a continual desire for more. Their creed in life was the same as that of Gordon Gekko's in the movie Wall Street. Have you seen that movie? At the end of that movie, Gekko gets up in front of a crowd of people who are head of a company, and he has this great spiel on the virtue of greed. And he says, "Greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all its forms, for life, for money, for love, has marked the upward surge of mankind. And greed," he says, "will save the USA." Now, in the movie, if you've seen it, Gekko's greed gets him into a lot of trouble. He ends up in jail because he was so greedy. And in relationships, greed will get you into a lot of hot water as well. Greed is not good, it is not right, and it does not work in relationships. Greed destroys. I don't know if you've ever seen James Dobson's videos called Life on the Edge. In one of them, he records an interview with Ted Bundy, the serial killer from the United States. And the interview was recorded just before Ted Bundy was executed in the electric chair, I think it was. Bundy killed 28 young women and girls by the time that he was apprehended. And what he would do was he would put his arm in a cast. He was at university, he was a very intelligent young fellow, I think he was studying law. He would put his arm in a cast and would carry his books around the university campus. And when he saw a young girl who he took a liking to, he would drop his books and she would come and help him. And then he would ask if she could help to take the books to his car. When they got to the car and had opened up the door, he would push her inside, shut the car, drive her off to some secluded place where he would sexually assault her and then murder her. He killed 28 people by using the same technique. Now, how does a man get involved in something like that? Well, Bundy says in the interview that he became involved in that whole cycle through pornography. He said as a kid, walking around the back streets in his suburb, he discovered a couple of magazines in the back street and some garbage bins. He started to look at them and he enjoyed what he saw. But then that wasn't enough, and so he began to look at more and more perverted material. And what happens when you begin to see women as mere objects to fulfil men's desire is eventually they become just that, mere objects. Objects that are dispensable. And that's what happened to Bundy. And in the interview which he granted Dobson, he says that that is what happens to many men. In fact, he claimed that there was not a murderer in prison who he knew who was not involved at some stage in pornography. That is what happens to relationships that are based on greed and lust and desire. They destroy. And Paul says in verse 20, "You, however, did not come to know Christ in that way." And he goes on, verse 21, "Surely you heard of him and were taught in him in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness." See, Paul says that we're to take off the old sinful nature and we're to put on the new nature, which is created in true righteousness and holiness. And behind those words, there is a wealth of thought and of theology. See, as we noted last night, when God made man, he made us in his image. And we saw that that involved three things. It meant, firstly, that man had the ability to reason or think. Secondly, it meant that we had the ability to moralise. And thirdly, it meant that we had the ability to relate. But as we also saw, Adam and Eve rebelled against God. They ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and they fell out of relationship with God. Now, what happened to the image of God at that point? Well, it wasn't lost. It was shattered or marred. Now, I'm sure that, like me, you have stood at the edge of a perfectly still lake, and you've seen the reflection in the lake of the mountains or the trees or whatever it is that surround about them. And that's what mankind was like in relation to God. He was an image, a reflection of God's character and being. But what would happen if someone came along and hurled a great stone into the middle of the lake or drove their speedboat through it? So you'd end up with a whole lot of ripples, wouldn't you? The image is still there, but it's marred now by the ripples that are in the lake. And that's what happened at the fall. Mankind didn't cease to be in the image and likeness of God, but that image is now marred. And what Paul is saying here is that as we come to Christ, and as we increasingly replace the old sinful nature with the new nature, then so the image of God is renewed and reformed within us. The ripples are smoothed out, and we begin to reflect again the righteousness and holiness of God. We begin to be the people that God created us to be. We begin to be fully human. Now, it's terribly important that we understand this. Packer says in his book, A Passion for Holiness, that holiness and humanness rely on one another to the extent that if I fall short of the first, I also fall short of the second. In other words, he's saying, if you're not holy, then you're not fully human. If you're not holy, you're not fully human. If you're not relating on the basis of holiness, then you can't begin to enjoy the relationships the way God intended you and made you to enjoy them. See, we're made to relate on the basis of holiness and morality. And only as we learn to be holy will we learn excellence in relationships. Psychology can't teach you that. It will try, but it can't. It's only as you come to Christ and adopt a holy lifestyle, it's only as you allow the image of God to be reformed and reshaped within you, that you can begin to relate excellently. Holiness is the key to excellent relationships. And that's why Paul goes on to describe from verse 25 several aspects of holy or godly relating. Now, what does this godly conduct look like that Paul is encouraging us to here? Well, he gives us six examples in these verses, and as John Stott points out, all of them have to do with relationships. And in each of them, Paul says, firstly, something that we ought not to do, and then something that we should do. But before we launch into them, I want to just make one point, and that is that we need to be clear here that Paul is not moralising. He's not saying to us, it's good to be good because everyone loves good people. He's not doing that. What he is saying here flows straight on from verse 24. In verse 22 to 24 he says, you were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. He's saying there that we need to put off the old nature and put on the new. That is how we begin to see the image of God reformed within us, by doing that. And these six examples are cast in the form that they are in because they are examples of how you go about putting off the old nature and putting on the new. Well, what does he say to us? Firstly, he says, don't tell lies, but rather tell the truth. Verse 25. Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbour, for we are all members of one body. Paul's saying there that we need to relate to one another on the basis of truth. And as soon as the basis of truth is gone, there's no trust, is there? And when there's no trust, there is no relationship. I mean, that's why we have so much trouble with the used car salesman, isn't it? Because you're never quite sure if he's telling you the truth or if he's trying to sell you a lemon. And so there's no trust there, and therefore it's very difficult to relate to him. See, rightly or wrongly, we don't expect him to tell us the truth, and so you don't know where you stand. If you want to destroy your relationships, then the quickest way to do it is to begin to tell lies in them, to hide things, to not be quite up front. That will destroy your relationships as quickly as anything. But if you want to relate well, if you want to relate excellently, then you must relate on the basis of truth. Paul goes on and he says that we ought not to lose our temper, but we should ensure that our anger is righteous in verses 26 and 27. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. And do not give the devil a foothold. Now notice, will you, here that Paul is not saying that all anger is sin. He's not saying that. There are some things that we ought to be angry about, that should make our blood boil. Abuse, injustice, seeing people mistreated, they are things that we ought to be angry about. And it would be wrong indeed not to be angry about them. There are some things that we should be angry about. But in our anger, Paul says, we need to be careful not to sin. Now, how do we know if our anger is sinful or not? Well, Paul says our anger becomes sin when it's harboured. See, if like Gough Whitlam you want to maintain the rage all the time, then Paul is saying here that you're sinning. That's not right to do that. We're told here that we mustn't let the sun go down on our anger. If something or someone is bothering us, then we ought to deal with it straight away, that very day, and not allow the sun to go down until we've done it. Now, I'm sure you know people who get angry and who stay angry for days. Maybe you're one like that yourself. Maybe that's your tendency, to hold on to your anger. Well, Paul says, don't be like that. That sort of anger destroys relationships, and it gives the devil a foothold in your life. And that's a very stupid thing to do, isn't it, to give the devil a foothold. Paul goes on and he says in verse 28 that we oughtn't to steal, but that we ought to work and give. He who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with his hands, that he may have something to share with those in need. Now, stealing is quite simply based on greed and covetousness, wanting something that doesn't belong to us, that belongs to someone else. And as we saw before, they are the two things that stop us from treating people as people and that cause us to treat them as objects. And Paul says we are not to steal or covet, but we are to work so that we can give and so that we can support and help others and do good to others. The burglar is to become a benefactor, as John Stott says. But then he goes on in verses 29 and 30 and he says that we ought not to use our mouth to tear down, but rather to build up. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, with whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Now in verse 29 there, when he says, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, the word for unwholesome talk or for evil there is the word sapros in the Greek. And it's a word which was used in the Greek language of rotten trees and of rotten fruit. If something was rotten, if you had a rotten tree there that was sort of rotten to the core, then you would say that it was sapros. And Paul is saying here that when our speech towards others is evil, then it acts like dry rot in their lives. It eats away at the very foundation of their lives and it destroys them. And rather than do that, he says, we are to edify, we are to build people up with the things that we say, not tear them down. The American writer Mark Twain once said, I can live for 2 months on a compliment. And that's right, isn't it? Someone says something encouraging to you, it's great, it makes you feel good. But if someone says something that's discouraging to you, then you feel the opposite. Kind and encouraging word is marvellous, but harsh words are like arrows, and sometimes we carry the arrows that people have fired at us for the whole of our lives. They destroy our very insides. Paul says, don't be like that. Don't tear people down with the things that you say to them, but get into the habit of building them up and of being an encourager. Then he goes on in verses 31 to chapter 5, verse 2, to say that we oughtn't to be unkind, but rather we should be kind and loving. Verse 31, get rid of all bitterness, rage and anger, brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. Be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. People can be terribly cruel sometimes, can't they? The fellow that I knew in a parish that I was involved with some years ago, who when he left home had his father say to him, "You'll never amount to anything." That's what his father said to him. They were his parting words. And that man is now a millionaire, drives around in a Mercedes-Benz, several other good cars, huge property, but he still believes that he'll never amount to anything. He's still trying to prove his father wrong. Kids in the playground can be terribly cruel, can't they? The things that they say to one another. "You're not going to be my friend anymore. I don't like you. You stink." But you know, the worst thing that we can do, the most unkind thing that we can do towards others, is withhold our forgiveness from them. I've seen families in my pastoral ministry literally blown apart because of lack of forgiveness. And Paul says that as Christians we're not to behave in that way. Instead we're to be kind and compassionate, we're to forgive others. And of course our model in all of that is Jesus. Jesus who came into the world to die on the cross for us, not because we deserved it, but simply because of his grace and kindness, as we saw the other day. Jesus gave himself up for us, he showed his love for us and his forgiveness of us, and we are to act in the same way towards other people. Back in verse 19, when he was referring to the way in which they related before they became Christians, Paul talked about the pagans giving themselves up to sin. But here in these verses here, he says that we are to give ourselves up to love, not to sin, but to love, to loving one another, because Christ has loved us in that way. Then we move on, chapter 5, verses 3 and 4. But among you, he says, there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality or of any kind of impurity or of greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. Nor should there be obscenity, foolish talk or coarse joking, which are out of place, but rather thanksgiving. Paul is saying here in these verses, don't joke about sex, but rather give thanks for it. And the two words that he uses there in verse 3, fornication and impurity, cover all types of sexual immorality outside of sin, or outside of marriage rather. But notice that he goes on and he adds the word greed. It says in verse 3, among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality or of any kind of impurity or of greed. Now I think that is very telling, isn't it? Because what Paul is saying there, I think, is that all sex outside of marriage is just that. It is simply greed. It is desiring to have a person, not because of what I can do for them or what I can give to them, but because of what they can do for me. And the results of that sort of abusive sexuality are terrible. During last year, I was the convener of the Church and Nation Committee of the Presbyterian Church. That's the committee of our denomination that looks at social issues. And one of the issues that I had to prepare a paper on was the whole issue of prostitution. And as I was researching, and I came across a quote from an ex-prostitute called Julie. And this is what she said. She said, "I've seen girls go lesbian because of their experiences in prostitution. They've been abused by men, and that is how they have reacted. Others go nympho. They get addicted to sex. It seems to be a distorted search for love. In prostitution, they never find it. I wasn't married, but I've seen prostitution break up the marriages of other girls. Prostitution destroys your self-esteem. You think you have no worth, and nobody could really love you. See, sexuality, wrongly used, does great harm to people. And Paul says that as Christians we mustn't misuse our sexuality and we mustn't be a party to its misuse. Instead, we should give thanks for it, he says. Now, how do we do that? Well, I think we do it by enjoying it and by using it as God intended. See, God gave sexuality and he gave the sexual act to be an intimate expression of love and affection between a man and a woman. And as such, it is among his most beautiful gifts to us. There's nothing dirty about sex. It's not the original sin, as lots of uninformed people believe. But rather, it is two people giving themselves to one another without reserve, without barriers, enjoying one another, receiving one another, accepting one another. In the context of marriage, sex is a holy thing. It's something that's designed to build relationships and make them strong. And outside of that context, though, it simply becomes greed. And rather than building relationships, destroys them. And it destroys the people who try to find satisfaction and fulfilment in them. Well, look at how Paul finishes this section in verses 5 to 6. Or 5 to 7 of chapter 5 of Ephesians. He goes on and he says, "For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure or greedy person, such a man is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of such things God's wrath comes on those who are disobedient. Therefore, do not be partners with them." Paul is saying here that immorality, impurity and greed are going to play no part in the relationships of heaven. And so he says they should play no part in our relationships now. Our relationships with one another now are to be a foretaste of the relationship of heaven itself. Not relationship on the basis of greed or immorality, but relationship that has as its basis love and forgiveness and holiness. Now, I'm sure that you, like me, want your relationships to be excellent. You're not going to find the secret to excellent relationships in New Idea or in Woman's Day. You're not going to find it in psychology or in some self-help book that you get from the local bookshop. But Paul tells us what the secret is here in Ephesians. The secret to excellent relationships is holiness. Holiness is acting in relationships the way that God himself acts in relationships. And as you commit yourself to Christ, as you commit yourself to putting off the old nature and replacing it with the new, then so God will transform you so that the ripples of sin die out, and increasingly you will reflect the image of God. Increasingly you will act in relationships as God himself acts. And as that happens, you will find that your relationships will begin to rise from the level of the ordinary up into the realm of excellence, into that realm where God himself relates on the basis of holiness and love and forgiveness.